Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Democracy-ish. I'm Torre.
And I'm Danielle Moody.
And we have a special guest with us.
Yes, so excited to welcome to Democracy-ish friend of mine, Jonathan Metzl, who is also the author of Dying of Whiteness, which apparently we all are now dying of.
Yeah, wait, are we black and brown people dying of whiteness? Are you saying white people are dying? Because I feel like we're dying of whiteness, not them.
We're dying of white supremacy, but go ahead, John.
Yes.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
I can jump in on that. No, you know, I think right now we're all dying of whiteness. I mean, the book that I wrote was really one about the profound negative health effects of basically anti-immigrant, anti-government, pro-gun policies in the Midwest, and showing how even though those were supposed to be the policies that made white America great again, in fact, they made lifespans kind of harder, sicker, and shorter for a variety of people. Certainly, they had profound negative effects for communities of color. That was kind of the idea. But what I found in my research was that they were also shortening lifespans for white Americans. And so what I argue in the book is, like, this is a wake-up call that, you know, really we should really quickly understand the importance of diversity and of having a more horizontal society. Because if these policies keep going, many more people are going to die. And that was before the pandemic. Unfortunately, now all the policies that I write about in the book are become national platforms by the Trump administration. And so really we're all under that umbrella right now, and everybody is at risk, just also, you know, in part from the coronavirus, but also because of these horrific policies that are based in racial resentment that really have horrible consequences for everybody.
The gun piece really hurts me to my heart, because the right would have you believe that the more guns there are in an area, well, of course, there'll be less crime because the criminals would be afraid, which is not borne out by any actual honest statistics. The more guns in a given area means the more homicide and the more shootings that happen in that area. So, you know, black people have been consistently pro-gun safety at a level mm-hmm. that is higher than white people were even after Newtown. Black people live in that area, and white people rose up to it, and then they went back to their normal level. But I think that the notion of racial resentment and fear that, what do I do when the black intruder comes into my home? I'm going to need a gun. That powers a lot of those attitudes, right?
That's right. And it's been right kind of growingly for decades. I mean, both parts of your question are right. We've known since the 90s that basically the biggest risk factor for getting shot is having a gun in your house, right? Because most shootings are not homicides. They're not, to use the NRA terminology, you know, gangbangers or carjackers or things like that. 2/3 of gun death is gun suicide and partner violence. So most shooting happens inside somebody's house. And I think what we've seen over the past decades is this real shift and transformation where the NRA, I think, has been very successful at promoting guns, basically saying, you know, you don't need a gun for hunting. You don't need a gun for whatever, like what people used to think. Instead, they said, you know, somebody's going to come in your window and steal your big screen TV and these very kind of racialized things. And really, they've sold this as a symbol of white protection and white authority. But the flip side, of course, is that it leads to unprecedented rates of gun death, really. Particularly in my book, I showed how there were dramatic rises in gun death, but it wasn't like urban gang violence. That's been pretty consistent. It's white gun suicide that goes through the roof when there are a lot of guns. And so, again, here's another example where what's being sold as kind of a symbol of white power and white supremacy is also leading to shortened lifespans for working class white Americans.
You know, one of the things that I also think is really interesting, Jonathan, that you oftentimes talk about, and you talk about it in your book, and you talk about it in all the conversations that you have on TV and on radio, is around the psychology of white supremacy. This is something that I find really difficult, especially in the age of COVID, to wrap my mind around, which is the fact that we have people whose understanding of liberty and their idea of liberty is really tied in their ability to oppress other people. Mm. We see that white folks, right? And I'm going to generalize and I don't care. We see that white folks who are protesting their ability to oppress other people. They are deciding who should serve them, who is expendable, who should be cutting their hair, doing their nails, putting their lives at risk for their comfort. And I want to talk a bit about that because, again, it's this idea that I think that they believe that their whiteness is not only currency, but it's also Teflon, right? That like this virus, while it is killing our community, the Black and brown people, right now, that it's something that is going to somehow just go around them, go around their whiteness. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think there are two ways to answer that question, and I'll maybe just touch on the both. The first is the more obvious way for all of us right now, which is that in this COVID moment, you know, there are a segment of people who are out there protesting, you know, white protesters are rushing the, you know, town gates in places like Madison, Wisconsin and Detroit, Michigan, and really, you know, AR-15 carrying, often not mask wearing protesters. And in a way, you know, I keep thinking when I see those protests really about some of the more extreme positions that I encountered in my book, which is basically the minute you code something as a Black and brown problem, all of a sudden there's this kind of understanding of it's happening to them, it's not happening to us. And this idea that kind of the white body, because it has an AR-15, is kind of invincible or unsusceptible. And so in a particular way, there are these extreme examples of this idea that basically the white body is going to be protective against the coronavirus. And of course, we're seeing now how dangerous that attitude is, because not only is everyone equally susceptible to the coronavirus, but a lot of times when people are out there protesting, they'll catch it, pass it around, and then go back and pass it on to, you know, workers or their Uber driver or the person who delivers their food or things like that. So this is a real network thing where it's a network of dying of whiteness in a particular way. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So there's a new poll, Quinnipiac, that has Biden up 50 to 39. But if you dive inside that, we are almost divided equally as a nation. Among white men, Trump is winning 56 to 35. And among everyone else, Biden is winning 57 to 31, right? Those numbers are pretty much within the margin of error. White men continue to this day, despite 100,000 dead, 35 million unemployed, massive coronavirus failure. Mm. White men are supporting Trump at 20 points and above. What's the matter with white men?
What is wrong with them, Jonathan?
With this guy?
What is wrong?
let me ask you guys a question. What would those numbers look like if Trump at the beginning of this would have done what most responsible leaders would have said, which is to say, we're equally susceptible. This is a new pathogen. We're all made vulnerable by the fact that we're all at risk in ways that we didn't know. We're all connected in ways we didn't know. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a more horizontal society where we take care of everybody because these disparities are wake-up calls for us. I wonder what his support would have been if he would have addressed it that way. I would bet that it would be lower, actually, even though that would have been a more effective public health response. Because really what he's playing into is this idea that basically it's kind of, he's not giving you life, he's not giving you longevity, but he's giving you this particular wage of whiteness, right? And so in a way, you know, he's still playing this card. And there have been multiple examples over this pandemic, this horrible pandemic, where he could have made a different choice. The one that comes to my mind is the minute this stuff started hitting red states, why didn't he immediately expand Medicaid in red states? I mean, that would have been easy. It's already on the books. It would have saved people's lives. It would have saved the economy much better.
But would it have made him money, Jonathan? I mean, we all know that he is deeply invested in hydrochloroquine when he should be invested in HydroCut, you know, whatever the weight loss thing is.
Hydroxycut.
That's what it is. What he's confusing.
I mean, like, he says he took it. We don't believe him, even though we kind of hope that he did. Yeah. It's sort of a weird sort of like inside out or through the apple. I mean, like through the looking glass of like, he's saying he's taking this thing, but we're sure he's not. But he says I don't even know what to do with this information.
Well, you know, it's just, you know, when I was doing my research and after my book came out, people kept asking me, so when are people going to wake up? You know, when are they going to wake up? And the assumption is like, what's the number of gun deaths? What's the number of uninsured? What's the number of schools that are going to have to close for people to wake up? And now partially that's a challenge, right? If you want to win an election, you have to frame a counter message. But it's also because this is coded in such historically and current racialized language, it's not like there's some number that's going to wake people up and they're going to change size. That's not what's going to happen. Instead, I think what we're seeing now is the kind of the entrenchment of these very dangerous ideologies.
You know, is it that, you know, because here's the thing, I get very upset with white conservative men. And I mean, that's like a euphemism. I can't stand them. But the what upsets me is this belief that we owe them something, right? Like they are owed something. Everyone else we need to create policies where we move everyone else out of the way, right? Donald Trump, his whole premise was about bringing America back, making America great again, to the point where women were staying home. So we're rolling back all of these abortion protections and all of these abortion rights so that women have to stay home. Right. We don't pay them equally in the workforce. So if you are forced into family planning, then you have to stay home. Right. Because it becomes more it makes more economic sense. I just don't understand how they profess to be great, but they need everyone else to be sidelined in order for them to actually be great. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it's showing up to, you know, to play a football game, but everybody else like has to be sidelined. They have to have one arm tied behind their back and like one leg tied to the other, but like you're free, but you're like, look at me, I'm the champion. Like that's how I feel that white men are. It's like you literally, you need everyone else.
It's powerful.
To be disadvantaged in some way.
Whiteness is powerful and fragile.
But how is that? How can you be both?
Well, it's also hierarchical, right? I mean, and let me just be clear, and I make this very clear every time I talk about the book. I'm not talking about all white people. You know, I'm not talking about white as a biological category. What I'm talking about is whiteness as a category of hierarchy. In other words, this idea that your white comfort is defined only if there are other people beneath you. Du Bois was writing in the period after Reconstruction about white men who had nothing. The only thing they were being sold by capitalism was that they were better than freed Black slaves who had even less. Right. So you never actually had to give white men anything except to say you're better off than Black men. And so I think this idea of a hierarchy, this idea that basically you don't have anything except for this privilege has been kind of almost epigenetically transmitted over time to the point where it leads to these incredibly, incredibly illogical from the outside kind of decisions, unless you understand how structural racism works. But the other sad part is, like, think about how much better we'd all be if this hierarchy wasn't the thing our country was holding on to. I mean, if we had equal access to healthcare and to food. I mean, I can give you countless historical examples where when societies go from being overly hierarchical to overly horizontal, it actually works out better for everybody. And so right now is an urgent wake-up call, like, let's get rid of this old baggage. But unfortunately, this old baggage is, you know, weighing down the ship.
You know, Danielle, I get, of course, very triggered and upset about white conservative men. But even at least they are promoting or believing in, espousing a philosophy that is built for and works for them. The people who really get my goat, who really piss me off, are Black conservatives who are believing in an ideology that is not constructed to uplift them or people right. like them. So it's Stockholm syndrome. You're believing in your captor's philosophy and what will make life better for them. It may make life better specifically for you when Can't Dance Owens is sort of like elevated to another position that she would not have if she was a liberal, but the ideology that she espouses does nothing for her. John, one thing I'm interested in, I'm curious about is like private white spaces, like when there are no Black and brown people around, be it family or friends or what have you, and racist things or even what you might consider borderline racist things are said. And some of the social science that I've seen says that white people tend to not police the idea. They don't say, hey, you shouldn't think that. They say to each other, you shouldn't, they either say nothing or they say, you shouldn't say that. Like, you should not verbalize racist ideas. Shouldn't believe that. Not that that's not true, but you just shouldn't say it. Is that your experience?
Well, you know, again, I hold off on, you know, so in other words, in my book, right, I'm a white American, obviously. I live in Tennessee for the most part. And I'm going around doing research with other white Americans. Like, I'm a Midwesterner. I was talking to other Midwesterners, and I heard some pretty bad things in my research. And it's hard, you know, I'm just thinking about myself as a researcher at that moment. What would it have meant? I mean, I challenged everything. I told people what my book was about. I told them the premise, the title, things like that. But I would say that I did feel like probably people opened up to me more because I was kind of in the in-group in a particular way. And I certainly think that what I heard, I mean, you'd see in the book was a lot of, you know, I think pretty honest thoughts and reflections. And part of that was some very, very racist stuff. But the other part was a lot of people who were just honestly opening up about how they were struggling. And this ideology was like the only thing that they had to hold on to because they were really, really falling through the safety net. And so certainly I wrote the book to expose the kinds of things that are said in privacy like that. But I also wrote the book. I don't want to say empathy because I think it's a kind of assumption, but I will say that I met a lot of people who really were struggling, and these ideologies, I mean, just think about it. The more desperate people get, sometimes the more ideological they get. Mm. And so I grow to understand at least how the rhetoric of Trump made sense in a particular way, because without that, the irony, of course, is Trump's policies were making their lives much, much worse.
But do they realize that, Jonathan? Like, that's the thing that troubles me, right? Is that as Democrats, we believe that we have the better policies, we definitely don't have the better story, because we can't actually verbalize that in any short capsule way that people can bite onto in the way that they do fear and hatred. But do they understand? Do you think, or let me say this, based on the people that you've spoken with for your research, for the book Dying of Whiteness, Do you think that this moment, as they're standing in food pantry lines that are wrapping around for hours in their town, as they have lost their jobs and their loved ones have lost their jobs, will they start to then look at Donald Trump as the person that is the causation of this? Or are they just going to double down on what he's doing and what the Republican Party is doing, which is frankly still trying to blame the black guy? Right. Like, you know, which is what we are seeing unfold all over the place.
You know, it's not like for the most part, people are like blind zombies who are just running into a meat grinder or something like that. You know, I mean, people were actually making informed decisions based on the ideologies that they had in front of them. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I do think that if they're now again, the problem is you don't want to go there, right? In other words, like it's not like I'm in any way advocating hierarchy, supremacy, all these kind of things. But I will say that there are recent examples from before the pandemic where when Democrats presented a compelling counter narrative that actually was true to Democratic ideals, but also met people's material conditions. And I'm thinking, for example, of the gubernatorial race in Kentucky and the gubernatorial race in Louisiana. Bipartisan support. It wasn't a slogan-y kind of thing, but it was basically like, I'm going to get your health care back. And, you know, things like really simple kind of things that weren't based on that. And so I do think that there are examples, not of extreme positions, but of centrist positions that kind of take people where they're at and at the same time don't espouse, horrible stuff. And so I do think that part of this is not just a you dummies kind of story. It's also kind of a challenge for Democrats to think about how can you, you know, again, not everything has to be appealing toward white people. I think that's gotten us in trouble in the past. But I would say that people are making decisions that I think are important to at least pay attention to. And certainly the economy would be another big one right now. And so, you know, again, I don't want to say that everybody's so far gone that they're just like, you know, the Walking Dead or something like that. I do think there's an openness if you can present a counter narrative to bring people over.
I wonder if there's a core philosophy that you see undergirding some of the racist comments you hear. Is it that they are intellectually lesser than us? They are less deserving than us? They don't work as hard as us? Like, is there a core philosophy undergirding the comments that we hear?
Well, I'll give you, if I have time, two examples, because I think there's an extreme and a mild. The extreme example, the extreme is just, this has been going on for 50 years. So in the South, where I was doing my interviews, every time there was any kind of pretension of change to the social order, desegregation, any kind of attempt at universal healthcare, any kind of attempt to create better schools for everyone, it's kind of an old playbook that just keeps getting kind of dusted off every 5 minutes or something. And so part of it is this kind of fear of change and this idea that I'm going to lose privilege or I'm going to lose this little thing that I'm holding on to. And it's interesting because if you look at a lot of the stuff Trump says, these silent whistles are, you know, you can just look back 10, 20, 30 years and it's almost exactly the same. And there's a Steve Miller every era and stuff like that. And so part of it is there's a long tradition of this language being used, I would say that. And then I think the other part to just repeat is that, it's like, I think a lot of times people also feel desperate and they feel like there's no other alternative. And so I think that in a way they feel like this is kind of my only shot, right? And I say that because I did meet a lot of like libertarian folks and things like that who really didn't like Trump very much, but they just didn't feel like there was any other way to go.
I just wonder, you know, I wonder because one of the things that annoys me about Biden in particular and just centrist Democrats are, you know, this push to always want to bring people back to the tent, right? Like we need to reach across the aisle and we need to talk to people that we disagree with and we need to bring these people back into the tent. And frankly, I don't fucking want them, right? Like I don't want the racists to return to the tent. Like I'm good. Like you let me know what you think about me, what you think about this universality of like, we're all humans, right? We should all have healthcare. We should all have access to education. We should all have access to clean water. But their belief in this scarcity model, right? To me, that is actually like what is fundamental to white supremacy is the belief in is the scarcity model. There is not enough, right? And so if there is not enough, then I have to hoard and take away from you as much as I possibly can because I am more deserving. And the idea about democracy, in my opinion, in America, at least the bullshit that we have been sold up until this point, now that we see that it's a farce, is the idea that there is more than enough, right? There is more than enough. There are just certain people that are greedy, right? But that there is the ideology of abundance. And so I don't know how you reconcile those things. But what frustrates me about a Biden is that he keeps trying to go over to those people and say, oh, come back, come back. And I'm like, no, I don't want them in my tent.
I mean, you know, I of course agree with you. When you were talking, I was thinking about the scarcity. It's not just scarcity of materials, right? And the reason I say that is because when I was doing interviews about the Affordable Care Act, for example, and we were doing interviews with two groups of people. We did interviews with African-American men who were quite medically ill, who talked to us about the Affordable Care Act. And they were like, this is going to be great for everybody. You know, if the more people who have health insurance, the better it is for our country. Let's get everybody under this tent, not just black men. And when we were interviewing white men, really, really sick white men, the kind of stuff we would hear is, I don't want to be in a system. Here's a quote from the book. I don't want to be in a system that's going to benefit Mexicans and welfare queens. This idea that basically there's only so much healthcare to go around and I don't want to be in a system with anybody else. And so if you think about how healthcare works, right, you actually want the most people in the system because one guy is healthy and the other guy needs a kidney transplant. You want to have shared risk and pooled risk and shared resources. So you actually want the most people in your healthcare network. That's how universal healthcare works. And so this idea of just wanting to create a system for us, it's not just about resources, right? It's not just about material things. It's also this idea that if we're on a horizontal plane, it'll be a kind of loss of privilege and I'll just be on the same level with everyone else. And so in a way, it's an ideology that is not linked to any material reason. And for me, it underlies not just the pandemic, but for example, you know, the crazy responses to the Affordable Care Act and to budget cuts in schools and, you know, on down the road.
It annoys the hell out of me. It really does. I don't know what I don't because the thing is that I don't know what to do with people like that. I don't know what to do with people who literally want to cut off their nose despite their face because they don't want other people to. Like, I am in a hospital bed dying. And my way of not dying is being able to is that everybody needs to get the same care and needs to receive health care. And you saying I'd rather die than give an undocumented person healthcare, or I'd rather die than give this perceived welfare queen anything, even though we know that white people are the ones that suck most from the government. Like, I don't know what to do with that. I don't know how to rationalize with that. And frankly, I don't have any fucking empathy. So I don't know how to empathize. I don't know where to go.
Well, again, you know, I just want to be clear. I'm not talking about everybody. I'm talking about the narrative strains that I feel like Trump and the GOP are appealing to, which is basically, you know, and when I try to put myself in the shoes of the people that I spoke with, you know, I try to think like, what's another time where I thought like I had some privilege or I had something? I mean, of course, I have privilege walking down the street, but I mean, you know, where something was going to be taken away from me, you know, and it's funny, but like, I think about it, like when I used to fly a lot, I'm not getting back on an airplane anytime soon. But like when you'd be on and you thought you were going to like get some upgrade from Delta or get whatever. And then they're like, nope, sorry. And it's like, no, wait, I have elite member status or something like that. And people go crazy at the airline because it's like, oh, I thought I had this particular privilege and now you're taking away from me, even though it's totally fake and manufactured and a marketing tool and just getting you to spend more money. But I think there are multiple times where, you know, I just kept thinking like, is that what it feels like? You're hanging on and then somebody's taking away a privilege or telling you. And I have to say, whether you agree with that or not, it's a very, very powerful marketing tool, right? To say, mm-hmm. I'm going to come screw you. They're going to take away something that you've earned and is deserved for you. Like, it's really hard to counter that. But I really think that that's continually what's being played to is this idea that you've achieved some kind of status. And that's going to get taken away from you if you don't block everybody else and stuff like that. And it's hard to create a counter narrative to that.
That's actually exactly everything that I hate about airports. Like, because it is, it really is. It is, it's the most classist place other than a hospital. Airports to me are the are a place where you just see privilege, right? Like, oh, not you, the first class person. And no, not you, first class person. The first class person that has an emerald pass can get on and sit in seat one, right? Like,
I know the Theta Scotchpole, I believe, was talked about line skippers, right? In this sense of the problem is people who are skipping the line, people who are, you know, getting something above or before they really should. And I work hard and wait my turn and don't ask for favors, which is bullshit. We all get something from the government, especially red staters get more from the government than their states pay in. But I work hard and I don't get anything for free, and they get affirmative action or what have you. They get these freebies that are based on things that other people did long ago. The notion that slavery continues to have a tangible impact on modern America is completely foreign to a lot of folks.
Well, if you read Du Bois writing about the period after Reconstruction, that's his argument as well. Basically, the idea is, look at this idiotic thing we just fought a war over, this idea of race. So clearly it's a load of crap, but it has very real material consequences. But if ever we're going to see, you know, we just killed like a huge percentage of our country over this, like this false notion of hierarchy. If ever there was a time to throw this out, it would be right now, because look at all the people who died. But it turned out that the opposite was the effect that made people more susceptible to anxieties about hierarchy.
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate all of it. And my last question, Jonathan, though, because I you know, is what do you see, if anything, shifting over the next 6 months? We have roughly 6 months, 160, I think it is, 6 days until election, right? We already are at 33 plus million people that are unemployed. We know that while the states are opening, right, these red states are opening, we know that the virus is not going to stay away from white people, right, as much as they believe that it's going to happen. Does anything shift from these folks, or will we all continue to die of whiteness, essentially?
Well, again, I mean, one of the stronger lessons from my research for me was that everybody was not monolithic. I mean, certainly there were people who were like, really far gone. But I met a lot of people who were just really honestly trying to live their lives and were scared. And I'm not saying that in any way to say that we should have empathy for horrible positions. But I would say that, I mean, if two things that we've learned in the last couple of years and certainly in the last couple of months, number one is the importance of winning elections. The importance of who's in charge for implementing things is very, very important. For dictating all of these things we care about. And so, and I would also say that, I mean, again, some people I met were espousing horrible things, and some people, I didn't agree with them, but they cared very, very deeply about the Second Amendment. That was their main thing. Or they cared about abortion or something like that. Like, it wasn't like, I mean, which has, as I say, in the book, all these ties to all these other racialized positions. But they were just kind of trying to make decisions based on, you know, the stuff that they cared about. And so I really hope that over the next 6 months, even though it's this pandemic catastrophe and genocide right now, that we look back and I think study some of the more recent elections where people have been able to cobble together centrist coalitions in ways that, I mean, look at Louisiana, for example, right now. Louisiana, a Democrat, won the gubernatorial election. Mm-hmm. Louisiana's doing a great job because he's been able to pull together Republicans and Democrats in a kind of common purpose, largely, not totally, against the coronavirus. And so I do think that centrism is not selling out your ideals. It's not having to, you know, get in bed with somebody who you disagree with on any of these huge issues. But it is a mode of governance that I think is harder to think about when we're all in our kind of echo chambers where we're all just tweeting with people we, you know, we know and agree about and stuff like that. And so I think partially, you know, we're going to have to look back and see how have these coalitions worked in the past in ways that created outcomes that are more beneficial.
Indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and your honesty and your generosity. We really appreciate it.
And the book, folks, just before we go, is Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland, and frankly, addendum, all of us, by our friend Jonathan Metzl.
Thank you so much for listening to Democracy-ish. I'm Torre.
And I'm Danielle Moody.
And we will be back next week if...
there is a country, which is less and less and less funny. Everyone, pray about it.
Pray about it. All right. Thanks, y'all.
Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.